I want to cover a few topics, as many as we can. Start from the beginning of the Seder and work our way through it. Torah says that one of the purposes of all the spectacular show that the Rabbanu Shel Olam did by Mitzrayim was l'man tesaper bo'oznei bincha u'ben bincha es asher hisalalti b'mitzrayim. You should know what transpired in Mitzrayim. You saw my hand almost openly. Miracles. Vidatem ki ani Hashem, and you all will know that I am God. There's a few problems with the pasuk. First of all, the Apirion, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, Rav Shlomo Gansfried, wrote a sefer on the Torah called Apirion. In there he asked the following question. If every father has to tell their son, why does the grandfather have to tell his grandson? The son will tell his son. Why does it say, L'man tesaper bo'oznei bincha u'ben bincha? Your son and your grandson. L'chora, every person's son is his son. So my son is my father's grandson, so I have to tell my son. Why does my father have to tell him too? I'm going to tell him. What's the purpose of telling grandchildren? Some say that it says the same thing by Matan Torah. Right? V'hodata livanecha livnei vanecha. Your children and your grandchildren. Why? Because we're giving over a Masorah. This is not what the Apirion says. This is just a nice, simple answer. The whole idea over here is Masorah. That you are creating a link to what actually happened there. So if the father tells his son, he's one link farther away from the source. He's one link farther away from Matan Torah. But if the grandfather tells the grandson, it's one step closer to Matan Torah. So it's more authentic. The Apirion, though, says another answer, but I want to ask two more questions, which his answer answers my questions too. The Torah doesn't waste a letter, let alone a word. Why did the Torah say so graphically, L'man tesaper bo'oznei bincha, say it to the ears of your children? And if the Torah didn't tell me to say it to his ears, I would say it to his big toe? Of course you say it to his ears. Where else are you going to say something to? So if it said, L'man tesaper lebincha, I would know, tell it to his ears. Why did the Torah have to say that word, bo'oznei bincha? And thirdly, you're going to tell it to your children that they should know that I'm Hashem. You already know it because you're telling it to your children. So why does it say, Vidatem ki ani Hashem? It should say, V'yedu ki ani Hashem. They will know. Not you will know. You know it already, otherwise how can you tell it to your children? What's Vidatem? Says the Apirion, it does not mean that you have to tell your grandchildren. What it means is, you have to tell your children in such a way that they will be capable and interested to give it to their children. Unless it gets to your children's children, you didn't fulfill the mitzvah with your children. Because the purpose of Sipur Yetzias Mitzrayim is not to tell your kids a story. It's to make them a link in a chain of Masorah. As we get closer to Pesach, we'll speak more about this idea. But the idea is that our foundation of Emunah is Yetzias Mitzrayim, Matan Torah, Kriyas Yamsuf. Here God put on a show to let the world know He's here. But not everybody sees that show. It happened once in history. But if the people who were there passed it over, excuse the pun, to the people, the next generation, right? And they now could feel like they were there. They heard it from somebody who was there. And then they heard it from somebody who heard it from somebody who was there. So if that chain is not broken, that creates a greater authenticity to our Emunah. It's one of the things that makes our Emunah emes. There's an unbroken chain from Yetzias Mitzrayim for people who actually witness these things. And if any generation breaks that chain, then we lose that authenticity. So the Torah says you can't just tell your kid a story. You have to tell it to him such a way that he will then carry it further and make sure that he becomes a link in the chain for the future. You are his link to the past, and he's the link to the future. But if you don't create him to be a link, he's not going to be able to give it to his children, or he's not going to be interested to give it to his children, then you're not Yotzei the Mitzvah. That answers my question too. Therefore, the Ritva says, that's why we say at the Seder, Keneged Arba Bonim Dibra Torah. Right? We have to know that there's four different kinds of kids. Rosha, Chacham, Tam, Enu Deli Shol. What's the... Now the Torah is telling me, says the Ritva, that if you don't tailor make the story to fit the intellect and emotions of your children, you're not Yotzei. Because it's not just to tell them a story. It's to make them capable of passing it on to the future. And if you tell it to them in a way that they can't grasp it, either because it's below their intellect and they're bored, or beyond their intellect and they don't grasp it. So if you tell a Tam what's fit for a Chacham, you're not Yotzei. And if you tell a Chacham what's fit for a Tam, you're not Yotzei. And if you speak to a Rasha the same way you speak to the Chacham, you're not going to get through to him. So you have to find a way to get through to him as much as you have to find a way to get through to the Chacham. Because if you speak to the Chacham like you speak to a Rosh, you're not going to get through to him either. So you have to tailor make the story to fit the intellect and emotion of your child. And therefore the Torah told you there are different ways of speaking to different kinds of personalities. Here's an example. You now figure out how your kid fits in. He's a mixture maybe of a lot of personalities, and use the Torah's example to get through to him. And that's why it says, Lamantasaper Beozne Bincha. It has to go into his ears. You can't just tell it in the air and expect everybody to get the same thing. You have to direct it towards that child and make it fit his intellect and his emotional state. That's the idea. And therefore, Vidatem, if you have to do that, and you have to now not just tell over a story, but you have to think, how am I going to give this over to my child? You feel that tremendous responsibility to be a link to the future, that you're creating a link to the future. You'll know better that there's a Rabbanu Shel Olam, because you have to work on it. You have to think about it. It'll become something much more meaningful to you. And it's not just that they'll know, but you'll know better than you knew before you started telling the story. When you have to tell something over to somebody, right? And you have to make sure that you do it in such a way that you understand that it's very important that they get the message, because they're going to have to pass it on further. Then it becomes much clearer to you than before that you gave it over. So vidaktem ki en Hashem, you'll also know. Okay, any questions on that? We could spend a lot more time on this, but as we get closer to Pesach, we'll speak about it again. Okay, next. You're all familiar with this medrash. I was wondering if you ever had the question I'm going to ask you. It seems to me like, how could you not ask this question? Paro, one of the reasons for Makas Choshech was that Jews had to die who weren't fit to go out of Mitzrayim. Which Jews were they? They weren't Jews who served Avodah Zorah, because it says by the Yam, Halalu of the Avodah Zorah v'halalu. That means the Jews who served Avodah Zorah went out of Egypt. It wasn't really the really nasty Rishoyim kind of people who didn't go out, because Dosan and Aviram went out. They were pretty nasty people. So who didn't go out? People who didn't feel they were part of the Jewish people. Even though they were slaves in Egypt, they felt that they were Egyptians. They totally assimilated into Egypt. They had no interest in leaving. They didn't feel Moshe Rabbeinu represented them. And they died in Mitzrayim. They didn't go out. Those were the people. People who were not interested in going out, who didn't feel that they had any connection to the Jewish people. They remained in Egypt. They wanted to stay in Egypt. They remained there, except not alive, dead. How many died? So Chazal say different opinions. But the pretty much accepted opinion is 4/5. Chamushim olu b'nei Yisrael, 1/5 left. 4/5 of the Jewish people died in Mitzrayim. Okay. So the Rabbanu Shalom did this under the guise of darkness, because he didn't want Paro to see Jews dying. Because then Paro would say, oh, you see, it's not me. It's like, you know, a general thing. People, Jews are dying too. So in order that Paro shouldn't see the Jews dying, the Rabban Shom did it during the Makkah of Choshech. Okay? You're familiar with all of this so far? I would understand that if 10 Jews died, so Paro didn't see them die, nobody knew about it, finished. But 4/5 of the Jewish people died. Before the lights went out, there were 3 million able-bodied men in Mitzrayim, between 20 and 60. The lights went out. 6 days later, there are 600,000 Jews left. 2,400,000 disappeared. And, surprise, the cemeteries are full. Now, you don't have to be a real genius to understand what happened. Paro was not an idiot, right? He sees that 2,400,000 Jews are gone, and the cemeteries are full. Ah, I got a great idea. They must have died. So when in the world did God benefit by doing this during Makkah Choshech if it was obvious that that's what happened, even if they didn't see it? Anybody, that question ever bother you? It's a good question. So what's the answer? The answer is the following. The Sefer HaIkarim says that since we live in a physical world, we are most impressed and moved by physical things, by things that affect our five senses, more than what we know intellectually. What you sense makes more of an impression on you than what you know. And in fact, in order to know things and to get emotions, you have to go through the motions. We will speak about this in great length, probably in Parshas Truma. If we don't have tests or something like that during that Sedra, we'll find some other place to do it. But in any case, I don't want to go into the whole idea, but the basic idea is that what impresses a person in this world, and that is the ideal, we'll see, is what you experience through your senses, not what you know intellectually. The proof of that is, there's a difference between knowing something intellectually and actually feeling it. The example that they give, what I learned in Tells, is the following. You walk to the park, and you see the park bench. All the park benches in America are painted a certain color green, right, wherever you go. And you see the park bench, and there's a sign on it, wet paint. What is the natural reflex action of most people when they see that?
Touch it.
Touch the thing and look at your finger and see the green paint. Why? Don't you believe the sign? The paint is glistening. But the answer is that seeing the sign and knowing intellectually that it's wet is not the same thing as feeling the wet paint on your finger. It's different. This is more real. Says the Sefer HaYikarim, that explains why the Ribbono Shel Olam told Moshe Rabbeinu blow by blow what was going down at the foot of Har Sinai when the people were serving the eagle. Yet he didn't break the luchos till he saw it with his own eyes. Not because he didn't believe God. He obviously believed him. But it didn't make the same impression till he saw it with his eyes. What you see, what you sense with your five senses makes more of an impression on you than even what you know 100% intellectually. Therefore, if Paro would have seen Jews dying, it would have made an impression and taken away the impression of the Makkos. But the fact that he didn't see it, he had to deduce it intellectually, didn't make the same impression. It wasn't the same anymore. What you see makes more of an impression than what you just know. And that's why it helped by Choshech. Any questions on that? Next. Before we left Mitzrayim, the Ribbono Shel Olam said that we should take gold and silver, but there was something else that's mentioned twice in the Torah and not mentioned once, which also needs to be explained. That is clothing, Egyptian clothing. We didn't only take gold and silver, but we took Egyptian clothing, usmalos. When the Ribbono Shel Olam told Moshe Rabbeinu what was going to be in the future, way back by the snare, he told him about the clothing. When Moshe commanded the Jewish people to go and take, he didn't tell them the clothing. He told them gold and silver. When they actually went, it says again they took clothing. So you have to understand why in the middle it left out the clothing, and at both ends it mentions the clothing. That's one thing. Secondly, and even more important, what in the world was God thinking when he told us to take Egyptian clothing and what to do with it? Not burn it. Put it on your children. That's what it says. V'samtem al b'neichem v'al b'noseichem. Put it on your children. What was the purpose of it? So let me first tell you what the Kli Yoker says and the Torah Tamimah, and then I'll tell you what I think. The Kli Yoker says that there was no mitzvah to take Egyptian clothing. But God foretold to Moshe that when they go to get the gold and silver, the Egyptians are going to offer them clothing too. And they should take the clothing and they can put it on their children. Don't be afraid. Meaning the following. The Egyptians, after Makkos Bechoros, are going to think that the Bechoros died from a plague. The first thing you do after there's a plague is burn the clothing because it's infected. They didn't know why, but today we know the bacteria or whatever that caused the plague are in the clothing. So you burn the clothing. So the nice Egyptians are going to say, the Jews are coming to get our gold and silver. Let's give them the clothing, infect them. Right? We don't want the clothing. Give it to them. Maybe they'll catch whatever killed our firstborn. So they're going to offer you the clothing. And the Ramon Shom said to Moshe, tell them when that happens. Therefore, there was no command to take clothing. But tell them when it happens. And the Egyptians offer you the clothing, take it. You could even put it on your children. It's not harmful. There's no plague over here. I killed the firstborn. It's not a plague. There's no bacteria. There's no nothing. Don't worry about it. That's the Kli Yoker. The Torah Tamimah says on just one prat, why put it on your children? Why don't you wear it yourself? He said, because the styles in Egypt were many. And they fit the little girls perfectly, but the grown women, they were very not sanua. But the mini skirts that the adults wore fit the kids perfectly. Now I'll tell you what I think. The Ribbono Shel Olam commanded us to take clothing and to put it on our children, because he wanted to teach us a lesson. And that is the following. There was nothing intrinsically wrong with that clothing in any one of the four halakim of the Shulchan Aruch. Because if it was, you couldn't take it and put it on your children. It was awesome. If it was shatnez, if it wasn't sanua, anything that could be wrong with clothing wasn't wrong with that clothing. It was 100% glatt kosher clothing. And you could even put it on your children. But had you worn that clothing the last 210 years, one of the zechuyos they had to leave Mitzrayim is loshinu es mabushim. They didn't wear Egyptian clothing. So why in the world now is the Ribbono Shel Olam telling them, take Egyptian clothing and not only that, put it on your kids? What kind of chinuch is that? So the Ribbono Shel Olam said, I want you to know something. Something can be 100% kosher. No problem halachically with it. But if you do that, you're never going to have Mitzrayim. Why? Because if you would have worn that 100% halachically okay clothing in Egypt, you would have been doing it to be like an Egyptian. That's treif. In the desert, there are no Egyptians around. Now you can judge the clothing on their intrinsic merit. Wear them. Put it on your kids. What's the problem? But in Egypt, you would have been wearing it to be like a goy. That's aser. Something can be 100% okay in one time or place, and at another time and place, it stands for something and it's usher. Even though there's nothing specifically wrong with it. I'll give you the example I always give. Two examples. So you hear clearly what it is. When I was in high school, the rage in the world were the Beatles. In case you don't want to admit you know who the Beatles were, I will tell you who they were. They were not the six-legged variety, but the two-legged variety. They were a rock band that originated in Liverpool. And they took the world by storm. The world was infatuated with the Beatles. And they started a few fads because of people being infatuated with the Beatles. One of the fads was, until the Beatles, no respectable businessman, doctor, lawyer, man ever grew long hair. Hippies, bohemians grew long hair. But respectable men did not grow long hairstyles. But the Beatles had long hair. So therefore it became a fad in the world that men started copying the Beatles and growing long hairstyles. It became fashionable for men to have long hairstyles. And whatever affects the Goyish world eventually affects the Jewish world and even the Frum world. So in the yeshiva, the masifta that I was in, some of my friends stopped taking haircuts. And after 3-4 months, it started looking like a co-ed school. So my rebbeim called in these boys on a Friday, and they said to them, you have a choice. You can go today and take a normal man's haircut, L'Kavod Shabbos, and then you can come back on Sunday. Or you can choose not to take a haircut and not come back on Sunday because you are suspended until you'll take a haircut. So you have the choice. So my friends were not daunted by that, and they said, but Rebbe, a Nazir lets his hair grow long and he's a holy man. We just want to be holy people. Take the haircut. But the Rebbe, the Ragachover Gaon, had a gigantic head of hair. You ever see a picture of the Ragachover? Right? Big head of hair. Rabbi Yosef Rosen. Why? They said he didn't take off his yarmulke, so he couldn't take a haircut, because he never stopped learning. So he had a gigantic mass of hair. We just want to be like the Ragachover. Get a haircut. Why? Because it may be true that there may be nothing halachically wrong with a man having long hair. Could be. Not for tefillin, not for whatever. There could be that there are things wrong. But let's say, assume there is nothing. You go through the whole Dalet Chelkei Shulchan Aruch, you'll find nothing wrong with a man having long hair. But if the reason you're growing long hair is to be like the Beatles, that's Treifes Chazer. So therefore, something can be 100% kosher for one person in a different time, in a different place, and for a different person in a different time and place, it has implications. I'll tell you another example. When I first came to Eretz Yisrael, so I even brought my sukkah with me. My sukkah that I used to have that overlooked my swimming pool in Miami and my, screened-in patio. In any case, so I brought it to Eretz Yisrael and I was going to use that sukkah here in Eretz Yisrael. But then I thought to myself, wouldn't it be proper if I had a Eretz Yisrael dikka sukkah? But I wasn't interested in giving up my regular sukkah. So I said, okay, I'll make a compromise. I'm going to get rid of all my sukkah decorations from Chutz Laretz, and I'm only going to have Israeli sukkah decorations. So I went after Yom Kippur. That first year we came in Elul. I went after Yom Kippur to go to Mea Shearim and to buy Israeli sukkah decorations. I come to Geula, and they have all the tables out on the sidewalk with sukkah decorations. I said, wait, these sukkah decorations look very familiar to me. As I got closer, they looked even more familiar. There were Christmas decorations in the original packing that said Merry Christmas on them. And all these Yerushalmis were buying it up like it was, these are obviously sukkah decorations. I was sure that I was going to go in Chol HaMoed into Mea Shearim and see a sukkah decorated with some shepherds and a little baby and whatever, and they would tell me, see, a ganze mishpacha, really? These Yerushalmis, at that point, this was 30 years ago, never saw a Christmas tree, never saw Christmas decorations. They lived amongst Arabs, amongst Muslims, right? There were no Christians here except in Beis Lechem, and who went to Beis Lechem? So, These were sukkah decorations. I'm sure that if Yerushalmi would go to America now, okay, this time of year, he would say, hey, these guys stole our sukkah decorations. Right? He had no idea what it is. For him, it's 100% okay. But for somebody who knows what they are, or to have those same sukkah decorations in America, may be a problem. Sukkah sagoyim. It's mamish copying the goyim. It's something that's miyuchad. It depends what it is. Sometimes these lights, they use for patios, for garden parties or whatever also. But there are certain things that are meyuchad for Christmas. right? Whether it's a wreath or a whatever, you get the idea. What there are certain things that are mamish miyuchad for Christmas decoration, and that's what they were selling here. So again, in Yerushalayim, maybe 100% okay to use them because they don't have any implication. But in America, maybe 100% also to use it. So you can't judge things on their intrinsic, is it okay or not? What does it imply in the place and the time where you are? And if in the place and time where you are, they imply something wrong, then it's wrong to use. Those clothing, I want you to wear it in the desert. But I want you to know that had you worn that clothing the last 210 years in Egypt, you wouldn't have gone out. How could it be? Either it's okay or it's not okay. No. It's okay in the desert. It's not okay in Egypt. And that's something a person has to know. Right? A lot of times, especially young women, or even younger women, right, have tainas. How come we can't wear this? How can we wear that? This style, that style. Is there anything wrong with it? And it could be that in another place, there'd be nothing wrong with it. But in a different place, it stands for something. And because it stands for something, it's wrong. And in the other place, it doesn't stand for anything. There's certain styles of dresses that in America, Rebbetzins wear. And here, if you wear that dress in a Beis Yaakov, you're thrown out. It's okay or it's not okay. Could be in America, it doesn't stand for anything. It doesn't have any implication. Here in Eretz Israel, it says, it makes a statement. It represents something, and that they don't want. So here it's no good, and there it's okay. And vice versa also. So that's the lesson, I think. That's why the Rabbanu Shlom mentioned the clothing to Moshe Rabbeinu. He didn't mention to the Jews while they still were in Egypt. Because then you don't mention Egyptian clothing to Jews and tell them they can take Egyptian clothing. He only mentioned it to them when they actually were leaving Egypt. Now you can mention the Egyptian clothing. Yeah.
Could the same thing apply, let's say, to music? Like, there's a song that you think is very beautiful and inspiring. You don't know where it comes from. And then, like, you find out that it's from somewhere that, like, isn't such a nice source. Then other people associate it with, like, not nice things or not nice singers. So what's the right thing to do with that?
Yeah, it could be that once you find out what it's, then you can't use it anymore. But it could be an Echanami. For somebody, again, just to give you an example. In the Beis Yaakov in Kiryat Sefer, near us, I once heard that between classes, they have bells that go off, you know, music. They're playing jingle bells. I thought, what? You know, they didn't know what it was. It was a nice song, right? But it really did not fit a Kiryat Sefer Beis Yaakov. It was like beyond belief. They had no idea what it was. It was a nice song. If you know what it is, right, then it has implication that's not exactly for a Jewish school. So yeah, it could be a tremendous difference with somebody who knows what the implication is and somebody who doesn't know what the implication is.
If, let's say, you know what it is, but like it totally doesn't, like you don't associate it at all.
Yeah, it could be. It could be for that person it's okay, and for somebody else it's not okay. Could be. I'm not saying I can't answer it except if I know exactly what it was. But in theory, yeah, it could be a tremendous difference. Look, I'll tell you, even something like Tanakh, something wrong with the Tanakh? No. But you know in yeshivas they don't learn Tanakh? You know why they don't learn Tanakh in yeshivas? Or why they at some point, the Dafka didn't learn Tanakh? Because the Haskalah used Tanakh as a substitute for learning Torah Shebaal Peh. They didn't believe in Torah Shebaal Peh, but they couldn't turn their back on Torah completely. There was, you know, like the early Haskalah, they were still frum. So they substituted learning Tanakh in depth for learning Gemara. It was a statement that Torah Shebaal Peh were not interested in, but Torah Shebaal Tzav will still keep. Then Tanakh represented the Haskalah, and therefore they stopped using it in the yeshivas. Sometimes when you get used to something, you don't change it, even if the reason doesn't apply anymore. So even today, where there's no more Haskalah, pretty much, they still haven't gotten to learning Tanakh again, right? But that's because of a backlash. But in any case, that's the thing. So even Tanakh, the Aseres HaDibros, they used to say them in Kriya Shema every day in the time of the first Beis HaMikdash, until the early Christians came about and said that nothing is significant in the Torah except the Aseres HaDibros. Then they took them out of davening. Something wrong with the Aseres HaDibros? No. But if we keep it in davening, people are going to think that the Christians are right, that this is something more important than the rest of the Torah. And it's not. So now it implies something, we have to ignore it. We have to not keep the Aseres HaDibros, but not give it special importance. That was the idea. It could be anything. Okay, any questions on this? Next.
I have a question. So for the places that will keep doing the same thing, even though the reason doesn't apply, is that correct? Probably not.
But it's very hard to change things overnight. So little by little, in the yeshiva world now, Tanakh is becoming more popular. Right? There's Svarim being written, and people are learning it be'iyun or whatever. There's Svarim be'iyun on Tanakh. It's slowly changing. But again, it wouldn't be the Rabbanu Shalom command them to take the Egyptian clothing. They wouldn't have had anything to do with that clothing, even if they were in the desert. But the Rabbanu Shalom wanted to teach them that lesson. So things slowly change, right? But it's slow. Nothing happens overnight. Yeah.
What if in certain communities things are looked down upon and you bring it in and you're not only using it for something neutral, like using it in a positive way, like certain pieces of technology?
just theoretically speaking.
I'm just saying, maybe. Then how do you work with that?
It depends. If there's a gather that, because most people, it's not germane to this, what we're talking about now, 100%. Here's a different story. The Rabbonim of a place, the Gedolim of a place, see that certain things, even though it could be used for good, but most people are using them for bad. And the dangers outweigh the benefits. Okay? Like certain kind of technology. Okay. And therefore, they make a siag that we don't want this at all. Can't have it. Okay, why? Because, true, it's curtailing the good use, but it's not worth to take the risk for the bad usage, even if you're going to give up the benefits that it has. Or, there are definitely people who benefit from this, right, but it doesn't outweigh the risks that are involved. And therefore, better nobody should use it, even though some people could use it for the good, right? Some people will not use it for the bad, and they're going to, lose out. But that's less of a problem than allowing people to use it, and most people use it for the bad, and the bad is really bad, and therefore, by experience, we found that people have used these things for the bad and really gone off the deep end in many ways, not just gone off the derech, but destroyed families, destroyed husbands and wives or whatever. It's therefore they decided in that place we're not going to allow this at all. Okay, it's not worth the risk. Okay, in that kind of place, even though you know that you could use it for the good, but if you use it, you're being poured together because you're letting other people see. You see that not everybody listens to the Rabbonim. So if they don't listen, I won't listen, and if I don't listen, I'm going to use it for the bad. And for me, it's going to have the bad effect, even though for you not. So in that respect, you are making it possible by doing that for other people to follow suit who are not going to use it for the good and destroy the whole aura that was created to make these things off limits in order to save the majority of people who will use it for the bad and to say that it's not worth the risk even though there's going to be people who use it for the good. In that situation, you'd be wrong to do it. On the other hand, it could be in another situation, different society, the difference between America and here. What the Gedolim here said about these things is much more strict than what the Gedolim said in America. In America, having these things are basically okay with filters or whatever, with certain safeguards or whatever. Here, filters, safeguards mean nothing. It's just also across the board. Because the society here, first of all, the benefits to a good portion of society and don't exist as much as they do in the States. People are more involved in society there. And also, the people here are not as used to having a connection to the society around them, and therefore any little connection already could be devastating. So it's a different society. So therefore, in America, though, if you decided, for me, this is a positive thing, and it's okay under certain conditions with certain safeguards, they'll be fine. But to have it over here would be imply something that means that what the Rabbanim say doesn't mean anything, and that therefore, if you can do it, then other people get the courage to do it too. Even though you're doing it for a good reason, they're going to end up using it for a bad reason. So it depends on the time, place also. It fits into this idea, but it's not exactly the same criteria. Okay, next. It says that Moshe Rabbeinu told Klal Yisrael to shech Korban Pesach, to cake the Korban Pesach on the 10th day. And he told his master Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh Nisan, he told him in 10 days you're going to go get a seh, put it, tie it to your beds for 4 days, your couches, and the Egyptians are going to ask you what you're going to do with the seh, and it's their god, and you're going to tell them we're going to shech it and eat it. And the Egyptians couldn't do anything. That's the reason of Shabbos HaGadol, one of the reasons for Shabbos HaGadol. So, and then on the 14th day, 4 days later, you're going to shecht it. So it says, immediately after Moshe told them on Rosh Chodesh, Vayelchu Vayasu Bnei Yisrael. They went and they did it. So the Medrash asked, what did they do? They didn't do anything for the next 10 days. What Moshe told them to do didn't start until 10 days later. So how could it say, Vayelchu, they went and they did? Says the Medrash, Kivin Shekibel Aleihem Lasos. Once you commit yourself to do something, it's mamish like you did it already. You get reward as if you did it. As long as your commitment is strong, then it's just a matter of time until you do it. Based on this, the Shari Tshuva says, it says, Kol Shemaisa Merubi Mechachmoso, Chachmoso Miskayemes. If somebody does more than they know, then their Chachma will be preserved. But if you know more than you do, then your chachma is not going to be preserved. So he asked a very simple question. How in the world can you do more than you know? How can you do more than you know? He says the answer is that you commit yourself to do whatever you learn. I don't know it now, but I'm committed that whatever I'll learn, I'll do. Then it's you can get already the reward for doing it, even if you don't know it and you haven't done anything yet. But you're committed to do it whenever you'll know. That's Nasa V'Nishma. That's called Maisa Merubi Mechachmaso, because the commitment itself is considered like you did it. The Meiri says, somebody who commits himself to do tshuva, even if he hasn't done anything yet, but he's made the commitment, he already changes the status, he's called a chassid. Status has changed. You have to fulfill the mitzvah tshuva, you have to say vidui, and you have to give back the thing you stole if you stole something. Those are details. But once you're committed to do it, even if you haven't done anything yet, it's going to take time to do it, your status already changed. You're a different person. So committing yourself, commitment is an extremely important thing. Okay. We have time for one last thing. Okay. Towards the end of the Seder it says, Umosha b'nei Yisrael b'mitzrayim shloshim shana v'arba meo shana. They were in Mitzrayim 430 years. When they translated the Torah into Greek for Talmi HaMelech, they changed that pasuk. They added some words. Because not true. We were not in Mitzrayim 430 years. Not only that, it's clear that we couldn't have been in Mitzrayim 430 years because we know that Levi went into Mitzrayim. And we know exactly how long Levi lived, how long his son Kahas lived, how long Amram lived, and Moshe was 80 years old when they left Mitzrayim. If you add all their lifespans end to end, which they didn't live end to end, they lived concurrently, not consecutively, it doesn't add up to 430 years. So they couldn't have been in Mitzrayim 430 years, impossible. So they said, they added in the Greek, Umosha b'nei Yisrael b'Mitzrayim v'shara rotzos. Because the whole idea of Galus Mitzrayim started already in Eretz Yisrael when Yitzchak was born, and he was a ger b'Eretz Lo Lahem. They didn't own Eretz Yisrael yet. So they were strangers even in Eretz Yisrael. And from the birth of Yitzchak, there was 400 years, and the 30 extra years were from Bris Ben Abasarim, which happened 30 years earlier, when Avram was 70. He was 100 when Yitzchak was born, 30 years later. There's only one problem. We have the Hebrew version, and there it says Umosha b'nei Yisrael b'Mitzrayim. What do we do with that pasuk? It doesn't say Bishara Ratzos. It says we were in Mitzrayim 430 years. I think an answer could be the following, and again we will expand on this as we get closer to Pesach. But if you look at the pasuk carefully, I think the answer is obvious. Listen to the pasuk. It says Umosha b'nei Yisrael b'Mitzrayim Shloshim Shana V'Arba Mayoshana. Vayihi Miket Shloshim Shana V'Arba Mayoshana Yatsu B'nei Yisrael Me'eretz Mitzrayim Al Tzivosam. What's the difference between the beginning of the Pasuk and the end? In the beginning it just says Mitzrayim. It doesn't say Eretz Mitzrayim. In the end it says we left Eretz Mitzrayim at the end of 430 years. Which has me think the following. Mitzrayim, Eretz Mitzrayim is a geographical place. The land of Egypt. Mitzrayim is a state of being. Min ha-metzar korosiko. The place in the world where that Mitzrayim feeling is the strongest is Eretz Mitzrayim. What's Mitzrayim? Mitzrayim means constricted, narrow. Metzar. Mitzrayim means who's a really free person? Person who is totally subjugated to the Rabbanu Shalom. He can really do what he wants to do. Because deep down, everybody's neshama knows what's good for him. But the Yetzer Hara convinces us that there's other things. But then we're a slave to the Yetzer Hara. It's like a person who knows deep down inside it's dangerous to smoke. But he can't control himself. So he's basically a slave to a cigarette. It's like the cigarette has a whip and says, smoke me. Even though deep down you know you really don't want to do that because you don't want to kill your lungs and the rest of your body, right? But you can't control yourself, so you're a slave. A slave to a little cigarette. So we're basically slaves to a lot of Yetzer Haras because our neshama knows it's not good for us. Deep down, we know it's not good. But we have other Ritzonos that constrict us and don't let us do what we really want to do. That's the Yetzer Hara. The place in the world where the Yetzer Hara was strongest was Mitzrayim, Eretz Mitzrayim. But we were in the state of Mitzrayim, constricted, and not able to do, as a people, everything that we really should have done or could have done from the time that Yitzchak was born, because we weren't masters over Eretz Yisrael, we never Torah, so we were much, very much constricted. So we were in Mitzrayim 430 years, but we didn't leave Eretz Mitzrayim till the end of the 430 years. At the end of the 430 years, we left Eretz Mitzrayim. Because we were only in Eretz Mitzrayim 210 years. But the entire 430 years of the Gzeirah of Golus, we were in Mitzrayim, in that state of being of Mitzrayim, even though we weren't in Eretz Mitzrayim for 430 years. We're only in Eretz Mitzrayim for 210 years. But we left Eretz Mitzrayim at the end of the time. But we were in Mitzrayim, in that state of being, for 430 years. The idea you get, there's a lot more to talk about it, but like I said, we have a lot to talk about as we get closer to Pesach, so we'll save it for then.